one.
We are one.
One is the beginning.
Are you one, Herbert?
I am not Herbert.
He's not Herbert. We reach.
Transfer complete.
Hey out there. Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, cracking his knuckles and jumping for joy, got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
Yes. And now, for this week's conundrum, we are revisiting the best, worst episodes of Star Trek.
We've done this once before, so this is technically Best Worst Part 2, but essentially These are episodes we consider so bad that they're good. So it's not just bad episodes or offensive episodes, the ones that make our skin crawl. It's stuff where, look, if you're a child, cover your earbuds right now as you listen to it, but episodes that are batshit crazy, essentially.
Exactly, and sometimes, you know, that's one of the great things Star Trek has accomplished, you know, where you look back at the history and you go, wow, what were they thinking that week?
were they thinking that week?
Yes.
That's the actual question there.
And if you go to our blog at subspacepod.com, I'll post in the show notes the link to the first Best Worst we ever did, where we talked about episodes like Sub Rosa and Bound, some of the greats. But a bit of the feedback that came out of that episode was people saying, well, why didn't you do this episode or that episode? So this week we thought it would be good to kind of tackle some of the ones that really, we really should have maybe tackled the first time around.
Yeah.
And some of the other ones that have been nagging at us. And I can say, you know, as we were pointing out this list and I was doing research, I was really annoyed at certain ones we skipped again. So I don't know if there's going to be we're going to make it a trilogy at some point.
Listeners, just be thankful we're watching these ones. But I would go back and give some of these a view just to see how ambitious maybe the writers were being at certain points in the game here.
Sure. And okay, if you want to do it maybe a little intoxicated, Who are we to judge?
So, Cam, how are we going to go through this episode by episode? Well, what's the strategy here?
Well, just as last time, in front of me I've got Jordan Hoffman, the host of the Engage podcast, official Star Trek podcast. He wrote a list a couple years ago for Playboy magazine, ranking every single episode of Star Trek. I think we're planning to do that next week, right, Tyler? We just got to get on our research.
We're going
to
write a list for Playboy magazine, yep.
Yeah. Okay. But so what we're going to do is we're going to kind of do the episodes in the ascending order of which they're ranked on his list, from the lower tiers around number 695. And I think it's kind of fun to see, A, how he ranks them, as well as which ones rank strangely high.
Right.
Like, unfathomably high on his list.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of issues with the list going through it, but I think that's part of the fun, too. So,
well, we see Jordan Hoffman in Las Vegas every year at the big Star Trek convention, so there's a couple instances where we should really call him out on some of his choices here.
He really hates some really good episodes.
All right.
So, let's jump to 694.
Wow, that's low.
Because Shades of Grey did not make the list. And that is the original series episode, And the Children Shall Lead.
Oh, Cameron. This is one where kids like going playing Ring Around the Rosie.
Right. And Hoffman had this to say. He said, insufferable and annoying and impossible to follow. This has the logic of a William S. Burroughs cut-up experiment with the added value of wretched kid actors. Dr. McCoy beaming at the end as young ones mourn their dead parents is one of the all-time what-the-hell-am-I-watching moments.
Yes.
And he says the only value is the obscure trivia factoid regarding the movie Zodiac, which is the actor who plays the Gorgon was actually involved in the real-life Zodiac case and is portrayed by Brian Cox in the movie Zodiac.
I actually knew that before I ever saw this episode, which is fascinating to me. But essentially, for those who don't remember, the crew find this planet, all the parents are dead. The children are all alive, and they don't really seem to care at all that their parents are dead. And it's this alien influence, surprise, surprise, taking place here. Cam, what exactly were the writers thinking here?
I have no idea. It's a really crazy episode. It's early in season 3, which is kind of strange. You'd think it would come maybe at the end, when they're really like, we just don't care. The show's getting canceled.
Yeah, after they got off to such a strong start with Spock's brain, yeah, it's shocking that they would have one like this at the beginning of the season, Cam.
It's kind of fascinating. This was an episode that just seems to have nothing good going forward. And yet, I gotta say, I kind of enjoy it. It's terrible, but it's terrible in a way that is so weird. Like, you look at the opening teaser, you're saying the Enterprise finds these kids on this planet, their parents are all dead. What is the opening teaser? It's like kids dancing around Kirk.
Yeah.
Well, William Shatner just looks confused. Cut to the opening credits. You're like, what am I here for?
Well, hey, you come back from the opening credits and Kirk's wandering into his anxiety cave where he's finding what he calls sympathetic vibrations. What does that even mean?
Wasn't that the name of one of his albums?
I have no idea. I think that was like a, wasn't that like a Brian Wilson song, you know?
Oh, it's quite possible.
Sympathetic vibrations.
Yeah, maybe. It was not 60s quite. Was a trippy time.
Yes, it was.
Right. What's especially fascinating is the kids are being kind of controlled by this vaguely defined creature called the Gorgon, played by Melvin Belli, who was a famous attorney. Are there a lot of famous attorneys? I guess he was very notable at the time.
You know, there's Robert Shapiro, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, he was the reason they cast Melvin Belli, I mean, who was not an actor, and I think it's quite clear in the
Shock.
Episode,
yeah.
is because they thought he would boost ratings.
You know what? Look, maybe in Southern California, do you think he was a nationally recognized famous lawyer at the time? I doubt that.
Well, the plan failed. Ratings were not raised, so I would say no, he was not nationally recognized.
How are they even like marketing him? He's a green blob.
Well, and he wasn't even supposed to be green. Gene Roddenberry was apparently so infuriated with how bad his performance was, they added the green glow and the voice distortion to try and salvage this character.
Okay.
Did they work?
I don't know what the original portrayal was, so I'll have to defer to one Gene Roddenberry's judgment here.
Yeah, like, what was your take? Because I've seen this episode, you know, three times before. I know we talked
before
about
Before
you
went it. To bed tonight. Yeah, I know.
Back in the day on this podcast, being Best and Worst Child Characters, we talked about this episode with Jarrah Hodge. I'm curious, though, you hadn't seen it at the time.
No.
Now that you have.
What do I make of the child actors or just the episode in general?
The episode in general.
I think it's like a train wreck, but it's not one that I was ever bored watching. Mm-hmm. I look, just even, okay, Cam, we have to talk about this scene here, the ice cream scene.
That one's on my list. Yeah,
the kid gets coconut and vanilla, and he is not pleased with it.
Yes.
They're both white. I didn't understand what this was trying to accomplish. Like, what was the point of this scene? He was more upset about his ice cream than his parents' death?
I guess so.
Okay.
Was that the brown-haired kid? Stevie?
They all look the same to me.
Okay, I think it's Stevie. And Stevie was the son of the guy who played the Gorgon.
Oh, okay.
And I think I told this story, but if I didn't, it still makes me laugh. Tom Ball, who was a guest on the podcast, he did our Ultimate Fighter episode. Him and I used to go to the Star Trek Las Vegas convention. And when you go there as a captain's chair member or a gold member, you get a stamp ticket to get free prizes, essentially. One of the things you get is an autographed Star Trek photo. And we went, and I got a Connor Trinneer, and Tommy got an autographed photo of Stevie.
What did he do with it?
It went in the garbage.
Did it?
I really wish I'd saved it,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, just as a joke.
I know. At the time, I think this episode at that point was kind of a vague memory to me. I hadn't rewatched it ever. And so I was kind of like, that might be the kid from, you know, I couldn't remember, maybe from Miri or something. I couldn't place it. But now I'm like, oh, what a missed opportunity. I would have that framed and on the wall.
All right. But well, you know what? I know about you, Cam. You're always busy, 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 busy.
Let's talk about another moment. All the right. Kids are basically driving the crew insane, right? We get some great Shatner acting out of that. But more entertaining to me was the Uhura mirror, where she's looking at her aged self.
Yeah, and she's absolutely like mortified.
She
like
turned into like the old hag from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
And I don't know. She was supposed to be, say, 50 years older. Cam, have you seen Nichelle Nichols in
she
the past year?
Held up a little bit better.
Oh yeah, I mean this is what's like leaving her petrified is her not looking so pretty.
Yes.
What kind of message is that?
it's a very 1960s message.
Okay.
It's a little, yeah, definitely misogynistic.
But
and Sulu thinks okay. he has to fly through swords.
Yes. Okay. I was talking to you a few nights ago, and I wanted to bring up this sword view screen where I did not understand this. Like, you're a Starfleet officer. You're essentially an astronaut, and you're convinced you have to fly through swords in space.
Yes.
I did not understand what any of this even meant.
It seems like a real reach. For
you have to reach for your sword. And, yeah, I get it.
The Uhura one still doesn't really make any sense. Eh. But it's like, I think that, which one makes less sense to you? The Uhura one or the flying through swords?
The swords.
Like, because swords aren't an issue that you would have in space. Like, why
what do they
it,
have to do with space?
Yeah, like, why isn't it a space phenomena?
Cam, what if you hit a sword?
I don't know.
It would bounce off the hull of the ship. Exactly. Who cares?
It's like, I can't tell what the point of this was. One of the other things that I loved about this episode is that it puts Bones in the position of caring for children's mental well-being. This is not something I would ever want or expect from Bones.
No. Yeah, he's about as comforting as a babysitter as maybe a character we'll get to talk about a little bit later on, but one Neelix, perhaps.
Right.
You know? Yeah. I don't know. This is not... he's a curmudgeon-y old doctor. I don't think he should be caring for traumatized children.
And this episode was directed by Noam Chomsky's cousin.
Yay.
Is he the black sheep of the family?
How come we haven't had him at a convention yet, Cam?
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, he's probably not alive, right?
I have hope that he is.
And this is his legacy, his yes. proud legacy. So I think one of the things that I really took away from this episode and why I enjoy it and consider it sort of a best worst episode is that maybe it's a personal thing for me. I find bad TOS episodes, with the exception of like the really boring ones like Alternative right. Factor,
yeah.
really fun. And I think part of it is how earnest the main cast is and how they are surrounded by absolute insanity. Like, I think some of the other series tend to curb the insanity. You know, they want to stick more to a little more a respectable tone. With TOS, everything is going absolutely loco around. But, you know, Leonard Nimoy, Shatner, you know, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols, they're all doing pretty solid work like they would any week.
Yeah, look, they're taking the job seriously, even if the script's about it. Do you wonder, though, like those actors at the time, I don't know if they quite understood how great the show was when it was on fire.
Right.
I just wonder if they'd get their scripts every week, do it, and then hope that the directors and editors would put together some sort of magic. You know, I'm sure there's times I open up the script and they're like, well, what is this? And then it turned out to be City on the Edge of Forever.
Sure. I mean, there's the famous story, you know, like Sean Connery turning down like The Matrix and Lord of the Rings because he was like, I don't understand them. Who could say whether some of the cast of Star Trek looked at episodes like Corbomite Maneuver and were just like, I don't get it. And then, right. you know, it turns out to be, you know, like a huge beloved episode. And they're like, oh, okay, I guess that worked. Like, I don't think necessarily a lot of these actors were sci-fi fans who really knew great sci-fi when they read it.
Yeah, I know great sci-fi when I see it. It involves kids doing pentagrams in the crew quarters.
I mean, it is an out there episode. And I am curious how on any conceivable level, when they came up with this idea, they were like, I think we got something here.
We got a winner.
And I mean, the Gorgon, kind of to end on a note with the Gorgon. I mean, the Gorgon is really in no way threatening. Would you agree?
Not to me. No.
If you'd been a child, would he have scared you?
No, I would have been terrified that my parents were suddenly deceased.
Sure.
That is what would have gotten a reaction out of me.
I just don't understand why they didn't make the Gorgon a little more of like an
salt
evil figure.
Vampire or something.
Something that's... You can see maybe like really, you know, like kind of grabbing these kids, almost like has like a vampire like hold over them or something. Yeah, I just don't get why he's so bland. He just seems kind of bored.
I don't know. Maybe the original, you know, actor.
Melvin Belly.
Melvin Belly. Maybe he was done up in a very terrifying way and the green blob just didn't do it for us viewers. Who
maybe
knows?
Maybe now, Tyler, I know you're not a fan of you know, offshoots of the, you know, the non-canon Star Trek, but I stumbled upon a fact about a non-canon a book about a Star Trek book that had a Gorgon fact that was so weird that I felt it was worth bringing up. The Gorgon played a role in Greg Cox's Q Continuum trilogy of Next Generation novels. He is part of a powerful gang of interstellar evildoers, which also includes the God Imposer from Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. There is a book that pairs up the Gorgon with the flying head.
Wow. Well, you know what, Cam? I just grabbed my notepad and I wrote a little story just a second ago in which it's all been erased from history. So there. My little story is just as valid as that little bit of fan fiction you recited.
Don't you think it's bizarre, though, that someone would be like, I'm going to take the two characters that people like the least and make them a point of my book?
Maybe the guy was trying to salvage those characters somehow.
I don't think he succeeded. So okay. Let's move on.
What's the next winner here, Cam?
So next, we jump from 694 to 673. That is the Deep Space Nine Season 5 episode, Let He Who Is Without Sin... Now, Jordan Hoffman says, other than confirming that Dax has spots all the way down her leg, this Risa-themed episode is pointless.
I wholeheartedly disagree with Jordan Hoffman.
Swing away, Meryl.
Cam, when you and I decided that this is going to be an episode that we wanted to cover, I just remember like thinking, oh man, this is such a stupid episode. You know, Worf becomes a terrorist for no reason. Mm-hmm. There's just like some really silly, weird stuff going on.
Yeah.
This might be what I would consider to be my version of Bound. Of course, listeners, yeah. Bound from Enterprise featuring the Orion slave girls taking over the ship, one of Cam's all-time guilty pleasures.
Yes, right near the top of the pile.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to call this a guilty pleasure, but I don't think it's without merits. There's actually a lot of scenes that genuinely made me laugh, whether it's, just antics from Quark with what are those idols called that will get you?
Like the sex idols, the one like the Riker gave Picard in Captain's Holiday,
the Juma Haran, the Horgons. Yes, yes. Yeah. Quark swinging away with the Horgons. He says, "I'm going to test these babies out." Just that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Here's the thing. This is why I do think this episode has merit, because the whole time you're wondering why Worf is being such a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very end, after he's joined the Essentialists on this Risa planet to take over the weather system and get people to stop having so much fun, he tells a story about why he has become so restrained over the years, why he doesn't embrace the jolly old Klingon lifestyle the way that Dax knows of other Klingons. And he tells this horrifying story about how when he was a young child, he killed a kid playing soccer.
I really do feel we need to have more dead children in our Pleasure Planet episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought this was bizarre. I don't know why they felt the child had to die in the story. Like, why not just have him be, he was in, critical condition for a couple days or something. Like,
had a broken nose.
Sure. Yeah. Anything. Like, just because, if you were someone like Worf as a child and you, say, hit someone and gave them a concussion, that would still torment you. Like, you could say, the kid was in the hospital for a week. Oh, that's awful.
Children have to die, Cam. What can I
say? It's really weird, because otherwise this episode is, like most, I find, Pleasure Planet episodes, it peters out about halfway through, but it's for the at least the half that really worked for me, it's fun, it's light, you're going through kind of the goofiness of Bashir and Leeta going through the Bajoran separation ritual, and I'm often confused when I watch Deep Space Nine episodes dealing with things like this, whether they're making fun of the Bajoran religion or whether they're taking it seriously.
I think
kind of like the gratitude festival.
I think in this case, the whole breakup ceremony that they're having, where you can go and have relations with other people, and then what exactly do they do? Like play around with the plate and decide that they're through with the relationship, Bashir and Leeta? I don't know.
It seemed to go pretty well for them.
Sure, hey, but although like Worf, like get your that stick out of your butt, with him like saying, what is Leeta doing? That's with another man. Or what's Bashir doing? That's with another woman. Like, screw you. Like, who knows, like, what kind of arrangement they have in their own relationship at this point.
And I didn't even know they were a couple.
Well, but, it's all part of the Bajoran culture anyway. So, Worf, like, back off, dude.
And, I mean, Klingon relationships can be quite different than human relationships.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand Worf. I really don't, because...
Okay. Sorry. I want to go back to what I was saying.
No, go.
Though, with the restraint. I think this was actually a critical part of Worf's development and explained a lot about this character that I've actually brought up before in the past. I completely forgot about this moment in the episode where we find out that the reason why Worf is so different from other Klingons that we encounter is because of this very traumatic thing that happened in his childhood. If there's one salvageable part of Let He Who Is Without Sin, I think it has to be this. Don't you think this explains a lot about Worf's character?
It is interesting that they managed to work in some really crucial Worf character building in an episode that I think pretty much everyone else has just dismissed as like a trifle.
Yeah.
And like, I know that they had far more ambitious ideas for this episode. It was based, or the idea kind of came to them from a 1947 Eugene O'Neill play called A Moon for the Misbegotten. It was supposed to be kind of a study of how sexuality, like, is the envelope of sexuality is pushed on Risa, and how the norms of sort of the current era, the audience watching would be uncomfortable with that. And they want to really examine sort of current attitudes versus the Risa idea. But they said they all failed. Like, it just failed miserably.
Yeah.
But I think at least noteworthy just that, for such a silly episode, it came from very lofty subject material. Like, they were taking the idea seriously. They weren't just going like, let's just make a dumb episode.
Yeah, and I think the biggest crime, though, is this is the episode that immediately follows Trials and Tribulations.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
You had so many people tuning in for that.
Yeah.
You could have had so much opportunity to get like a really great episode to follow it up and show all these casual viewers what Deep Space Nine is when it's firing on all cylinders. And you have one, I think it was kind of a risk for the writers, even if they had high ambitions for this one, to follow up with such a light episode.
Well, two in a row. Why would they do that?
I don't know, Cam. Maybe, I think, honestly, Sweeps, you have Vanessa Williams as your big guest star here.
Do you think she lifted ratings more than Melvin Belly did for And the Children Shall Lead?
Actually, I do.
Did she?
Yeah, I have to believe that. But
although, I'll bet you And the Children Shall Lead was watched more than this episode.
No, yeah, hey, back in the day, yeah. Like, they're like, what, Star Trek's only getting 30 million viewers?
It was like, this is a wagon train.
Yeah.
Season 25.
Yeah. So, I think there's enough fun stuff going on. I'm not taking this episode too seriously.
Yeah.
I would never describe it as without merit, if only for the Worf stuff, as well as the fact that we find out that Leeta finds Rom to be cute and sexy.
I actually really liked that moment. I thought that was fun. Another, actually, moment that I really liked was another reference to Captain Baudet.
Yes, the Calamite.
Yeah, with the transparent skull. Like, I like that it, you know, it's not just like an offshoot goofy episode. It actually ties in DS9 mythology. I think that is one thing that actually, at least for me, holds this episode back from, say, like, And the Children Shall Lead, from really embracing the full-blown, like, absurdity of the episode. Like,
sure.
There's actual, you know, character building going on that affects the characters moving forward.
Yeah.
Like, this episode matters. Whereas, like, some of my favorite best works, they really don't matter.
Yeah. Cam, do we need to see a Gallimite on Star Trek Discovery?
Let's just hope that show makes it to the air. A Gallimite or no.
Hey, no, it's making it to the air no matter what. But,
that's true.
Yeah. All right. And, before we go to the next episode, I just have to point out, I'm glad that we see that Morn is getting some loving, too, at the beginning of this episode.
I like that, too.
Yeah.
Anytime they can give Morn a little more to do than just, you know, drinking or talking to Quark, I enjoy that.
Or spitting out latinum from his fourth stomach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I dig.
It's kind of a bummer, though. The entire cast is really down on this episode. Like, Rene Auberjonois directed it. Mm. He was down on it. The writers, Ira Stephen Bear and Robert Hewitt Wolf, they don't like it. And Sidigal Fidel really is not happy with his performance because Nana Visitor had given birth to his child the night before they filmed the big scene, like the breakup scene between him and Leeta.
Yeah.
So he says, you know, like, he just looks at it and he sees an actor who has not even paying attention.
Right. I don't blame him.
Pick that up, I will say, to his credit.
I will say maybe Bashir seemed a little aloof in the episode, but I thought that was a choice on the part of Sidigal Fidel because he's on Risa, man.
He'd prefer you think that.
Okay. Well, I just disagree with the idea that this is a worthless episode. And it's not excruciating to sit through. There's some fun stuff and there's some stuff, character moments. It's just a really weird one where they go to Risa and Worf becomes a terrorist.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
Yeah.
Weirdly timely, though, this episode now, you know?
Sure.
You could actually take some things away from it nowadays. Like, I think if you tackled this same material with, you know, a more confident script, you know, it's not without value.
You just want a Horgon.
I do.
Yeah.
So, let's jump up to number 616 on Jordan Hoffman's list. Just ahead, actually, of Meld and Non Sequitur. Two episodes I think are actually pretty good.
Yeah, I like both of those.
To another Voyager episode from season 5 called Once Upon a Time.
Okay.
And Jordan Hoffman says, Neelix babysits Naomi Wildman. I'm 100% pro Neelix, but even I say this one is too much.
Cam, this was somewhat traumatic for everybody involved, all the characters I'm talking about here. We really find out, if I am Naomi Wildman, would I, what left her to leave her child in the care of Neelix, though?
There's got to be better options. Is it just because he has the most free time?
I think so. He doesn't have to have work duties, and you know, maybe he's got kitchen duties, but beyond that, he doesn't have to be at a console. Like, he can leave Naomi. I said Naomi Wildman. I meant Samantha Wildman.
Right.
But he could leave Naomi at, I don't know, a table to draw or something. But essentially, like, for those who don't recall, yes, Neelix babysits Naomi Wildman because Samantha Wildman crash lands on a planet.
I want to say something about that after, but okay. Continue your synopsis.
Crash lands on a planet. Her life is very much in peril, and Neelix refuses to tell Naomi that anything's wrong. Instead, they spend all their time in the most effed up sort of holodeck program, or maybe second most effed up sort of holodeck program. You could
more on that later.
Yeah, more on that later. But featuring Flotter and Treebus, two of the dumbest characters I've ever seen in the Star Trek universe. Apparently, they're huge among all young people on planet Earth. Harry loves them. Janeway loves them. So does Samantha Wildman. Right. Spoiler alert, she makes it to the end. This episode centered around the fact that you have to watch to find out if this girl's going to be orphaned and left in the care of Neelix, who is in no way, shape, or form fit to take care of her. It's like this is a Neelix episode.
Yeah,
he's dealing with the trauma of losing his own family in that brutal war. He's waking up in the middle of night screaming his head off with Naomi just a few feet away, like in her bed, and then he goes like creepily like inspects her to make sure she's okay, and it's just like, oh man, like this episode is so weird, Cam.
Naomi Wildman has more emotional maturity than Neelix. Yes. In this episode,
I think she's learning a lot from Seven of Nine just in the one short scene that they share together. Yeah, you know?
And that was the best thing to come out of the episode, really, the relationship between her and Seven. But the thing about Naomi Wildman is, you know, she's played a little older for her age, which I like. You know, it's a kid who's not too precocious to the point of being nauseating.
Well, it's tough to figure it out because she is half alien. So,
yeah.
Like, and she was born like 3 years earlier. I think it's totally justified to say whatever her age is, you right. can totally rationalize sure. it in your brain because she's half alien. Sorry, sure. I digress.
No, but I mean, pairing her with Neelix is really questionable, and it kind of completes, at least in my head, this transition that Neelix went from season one to kind of where he's kind of a tormented figure who finds a home in Voyager to full man-baby mode.
Yes.
Like, by season really four, when Braga really takes the reins over, Neelix becomes just, like, this weird, sexless man-baby where he's just, like, very strange.
But it coincides with the departure of Kes as well.
Right, yeah.
Which I think is important.
Yeah,
so he goes from, like, the jealous, domineering kind of dude to, yes, the man-baby.
Yeah.
And
this episode, it might be the ultimate representation of that.
I would say so. I mean, I think there's a story worthy of telling behind this, with Neelix still dealing with the trauma of losing his entire family in a horrible, horrible way.
Yeah.
But, Cam, the reason why this is on our list, though, I think it has to be because of the Flotter and Treebus holodeck stuff going on here. I heard rumors of this coming up. You know, I ran my old Star Trek Voyager site back in the day, and I heard
you wrote fan fiction about Treebus, right?
No, not about Treebus. I did write fan fiction, though.
Yeah, I know.
Don't laugh. I was a young lad. But Cam, what did you make of the fact that we had to devote about half an episode to these really stupid holodeck characters?
The sad part is, rewatching this episode, now you and I had really kind of batted back and forth between this or another Voyager episode.
Which we might save for another episode.
We are definitely saving.
Okay.
When I was watching this episode, I actually thought we made the wrong call.
Okay.
Because I really began to feel like, oh man, there's not as much of the Flotter stuff as I remembered.
Sure.
Like, I wanted more because it would have made it that much crazier. Whereas we spent so much time with the Samantha Wildman crashed ship stuff that I was like, oh man, this is just dull. And yeah. I want to get back to, you know, because you'd mentioned that earlier about her crash. I think that's one of the hugest problems with this episode, is that she's in this incident, right off the bat, we see she's with Tom Paris, Tuvok. We know nothing's going to happen. Like, yeah. The drama is sucked out of it. Why couldn't it have been a solo mission? Why couldn't it have been them trying to get Samantha Wildman back? It just removes all the stakes.
No, you're absolutely right. The stakes are removed there because we know that our two main characters are going to make it out alive. And I think also from a dramatic perspective, I don't know if Star Trek is going to hinge so much drama on the fact that a girl's going to be left orphaned.
Right.
You know, and the other thing is...
Plus, you know, we've seen in the bonding, children don't care.
No. Yeah, but I don't know. I think that this Samantha Wildman character is given a real disservice throughout. You know, like, she gets a kind of pushed to the side in to focus on Naomi instead.
Well, this is her final episode.
Samantha, I think
she pops up again in Fury. In a flashback, you know, when Kes goes back in time.
Yeah.
But this is the last of her sort of chronological appearances.
So she must have been thinking, Nancy Hauer at the time, thinking, oh, well, they're developing my child. I'm going to get a whole lot more screen time at this point.
Right.
I guess they were enamored enough by Scarlett Palmer that they figured they could dump Nancy Hauer and just focus on her. But I don't know. This, I think there's so much potential to be addressing actual parenthood,
mm-hmm.
aboard a ship lost on the other side of the galaxy. You're missing one of the parents in the equation here. You're a single mother.
That's a real thing that would be interesting to look at with a character, because you have a child on a ship, you're lost in the Delta Quadrant. What are your responsibilities to Starfleet versus, you know, your child who has no other parent there?
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting thing that Voyager has no interest
then,
in exploring.
Just dropped the ball on something that could have been actually... interesting. Instead, we get man baby Neelix
weeping
a lot. I
really like the scenes of Janeway like really giving him crap.
Yeah,
it
was like she was the audience surrogate at this point. Like,
yeah.
Get your ass together, like Neelix. Like, this is just ridiculous, man. Like, I'm trying to give Neelix credit here, like, for his own actions. Why keep this news from Naomi? I still can't justify it, like, in my own head as to why he would do that, no matter the trauma that he endured as a young man. He wasn't a kid when his family died, though. He was we knew before that he was a passive observer.
Right.
What's the word I'm looking for?
Conscientious objector.
Conscientious objector. So he would have been age majority when his family died.
Right.
So I'm not saying that's not going to be traumatic, but I don't know. This is a tough episode for me to find the merits behind in a lot of places.
I'm reminded there was one time this guy stopped me when I was getting off a bus, and I was carrying like videos I'd gotten at the library, and he just like said, "Oh, you know, you've got a lot of movies there." And right away, you know, we both live in Vancouver. You get approached by crazy people often in the streets. This was in North Van though, which is less likely. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I was just at the library." And then he broke down crying to me and saying, "Like, movies are the only thing that helped me rediscover my innocence." That is what I was thinking as I was watching Neelix in this episode, was that guy sobbing to me outside a bus, okay. You know, just like, oh my God.
But Cam, we are doing a disservice to our own podcast, though. We're not touching upon the reason why we included this episode.
Sure, Flotter and Treeves?
Yeah, I'll go back to that question I asked you earlier.
Yeah.
What do you make of Flotter and Treeves, though?
I don't hate Flotter and Treeves. I kind of don't like the storytelling. I think Star Trek does whimsy very badly. And
yes.
That's something we're going to get to later in this episode as well. But to me, Treeves and Flotter are actually, I really like the makeup. I think they're well played. Like Flotter.
Wait, you like the Flotter makeup with like the glitter?
It's original. Yeah, like I think
it looks like cheap 90s like high school play
I think
costume.
I don't know. I think the design is kind of fun. I actually am not against the Flotter makeup job. And I think he's played by Wallace Langham, who played Hodges on CSI for like a lot of seasons, like, I don't know, 12 seasons or something. And I think he's doing a really good physical job. I think both actors really have, you know, a lot of physicality to the performances that I think are well done. Like, when we compare these to some other characters we're going to see later in another episodes in this list, I think they actually do a much better job. And I think Treeves and Flotter have character. And I mean, I'm not against them. I don't hate them. They're not characters that I want to see a lot more, but, you know.
Well, I disagree with you on Flotter. I do think the makeup for Treeves was quite well done. Like,
right.
I was impressed with that. I'll give you credit there. Yeah, they do have character. Just little moments as well, like when Treeves falls to the ground and he goes, "Timber." Like, that was like, okay, that's fun. But just think about this children's story where this fire monster comes and burns down the entire forest,
yeah,
leaving like all these characters like homeless. I understand why Neelix is having like flashbacks, like PTSD at this point. Like, what? Who's programming this for children? This is not a children's like holodeck program.
As a child of the 80s, a lot of the 80s, you had these dark fantasy movies like Return to Oz or The Dark Crystal. This, to me, kind of feels like the equivalent of what kids in the 24th century might watch or experience that is similar.
Like Labyrinth.
Yeah, where like adults go like, who is this made for? Yeah. Whereas like kids kind of like being scared.
Okay, but post-80s, we don't really get that much anymore, do we?
That's because we take it like, too easy on the kids.
I think they're all a bunch of wussies now.
Yeah, adults too, you know. We're all just, we need the edges filed down.
Yeah, go see the Boss Baby, guys.
Yeah, I would have been curious, like, originally when they wanted to do this episode, it was going to be an Alice in Wonderland episode. Like, it wasn't even going to be this crash-landed ship, anything like that. It was going to be predominantly, like, a holodeck episode featuring Alice in Wonderland and then Neelix and Naomi. And there was going to be like a war going on outside. But the war thing got shot down because of the Dominion War at Deep Space Nine at the same time. And then it became...
Yeah, that would have been incredibly confusing
for
viewers.
It's one of those stupid things that you're like, that makes no sense. But I'm sure a studio exec really thought that was an important thing. And I don't know why they dropped the Alice in Wonderland. But eventually they just went with Flotter and Treeves. I really don't understand why.
I think it would have been more interesting if we just had Neelix trying to take this young child's attention away from something very scary that's going on outside. The thing is, she keeps going into this holodeck program, and Neelix is like, "I'm not so sure if you should." Like,
he's not using it to distract her.
Yeah. So I'm left to wonder what exactly is the point of this holodeck program other than it induces PTSD in Neelix.
I don't know. They said like the script was basically written by committee. Because they had to rewrite it.
That's always a good idea.
They had to rewrite it like real close to the date, and they didn't have a second act or something and what have you. So I think this is a real case of just a disaster episode where the Treeves and Flotter stuff maybe isn't ultra offensive, and the crash landed ship isn't ultra offensive, but like you put these two things together with a weird Neelix portrayal, and it all just comes crashing down.
Okay. Cam, what is next on one Jordan Hoffman's list here?
Okay, so we jump from number 616 on his list to number 388.
Wow,
we took a real jump.
We'll have to mock Jordan Hoffman when we see him in Vegas this year.
Yeah, like we jumped over a whole bunch of quality episodes to get to 388.
But you know what? Maybe he thinks these are good, bad episodes as well. They're so bad, they're good to watch.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, at number 388, we have The Cost of Living.
Oh,
from The Next Generation. He says, "I agree with sticking Alexander with Loxana, but the idea is to get them off screen and not film them." And that was that high on his list with that write-up.
Rather derisive.
Like 300 spots above or 200 spots above Non Sequitur, the Harry Kim episode that's actually really good.
Do you recall what was near that episode on his list as well?
It's just before The Time Trap from the animated series and Dagger of the Mind from the original.
Okay. Well, there you go.
So,
anyway, Cam, what do you make? Okay, look, we know this is a Loxana Troi episode. She's getting married. Worf is having problems with his raising his son.
Yeah,
I personally think Deanna Troi is giving Worf horrible parental advice. But I
also thought Worf was being a horrendous parent in that scene. So I was like, I don't even know what advice I would give.
It's a consistent thread with Worf. He's not a good father.
No.
We've talked about that before. But the problem is, like, okay, Deanna Troi is telling them to sign a contract between parent and child, which if I'm a parent, I'm not signing any contract with my kid.
Right.
The problem is, then you have Loxana come on. She's completely undermining Deanna Troi. And I agree with Loxana. Like, it's horrible advice to do, but, like, you can't go in and undermine your own child's job as well. To a certain degree, she is close to Worf and Alexander. So it's like her personal life as well. Okay, this is frustrating enough. I figure, maybe we can get a little whimsy going on if Loxana runs off with Alexander in the holodeck. Cam, what do you make of this pleasure colony that she takes?
The parallax colony?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of a realm for free spirits. You know, Treeves...
Because once again, the reason we're talking about this particular episode, I think it's because of the holodeck aspect of it.
Yes. Yeah, it's the holodeck, yes, for sure. This particular creation is horrifying. You know, we talked about Treebus and Flotter and said that's pretty nightmare-inducing. They ain't got nothing on the Parallax Colony. The Parallax Colony is like hell sprung to Earth. It is awful.
This seems like something from your 80s childhood as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I was reminded of, like, the most, like, horrific scenes from Return to Oz.
Although, I will say this, Cam. If we talk about the Wind Dancer, that is that bubble-headed sort of thing, in that its head is disembodied and it's just floating in a bubble, kind of clown makeup painted on. I know for a fact you've gotten a lot of pleasure out of this particular character, just based on the images you've taken with your phone and then sent to me as you watch this episode.
And I love that the new TNG Blu-ray box set, if you pull out the two sets of discs, that Wind Dancer head is inside of the box.
Whose idea was that, Cam? You and I went back and forth on who possibly could have loved that Wind Dancer so much that they put them inside the box of the box set.
There is someone out there on that design team that had a real sense of humor about that episode. And, you know, I'm glad to know that we aren't the only ones that thought it was completely insane. Did you know who played the Wind Dancer?
No. Who?
It's actually Larry Hankin. The name might not mean anything to you, but he was Mr. Heckles on Friends.
Oh, okay.
He also played the Kramer actor in the Seinfeld pilot episode where they're shooting the pilot. He also played Carl in Billy Madison.
You know, it's now that you say it, I can totally picture him playing that role, making those faces. I do think the one redeeming quality about the Wind Dancer, though, is that did make me laugh is when Worf came and just popped him.
Yes.
Like, that was legit funny, though.
Now, would you say the Wind Dancer is the most likable member of this entire... Okay, take that off the table for a second.
Okay.
Who would be the member of the Parallax Colony you want to spend time with the least?
The least. I would have to... Who's that orange guy who looks like the Cowardly Lion?
Oh, the poet.
Yeah. Like, that guy seems like a total bummer.
What is his, like, line that Alexander rips off?
What was it? The hour of laughter? Or is that the...
You mean the higher, the fewer?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The higher, the fewer.
What does that mean?
I have no idea.
He keeps repeating it through the episode, and I felt like a complete idiot, because I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about.
You're too distracted by the Wind Dancer still. You know, you're just swept away. Your mind kept going back. You weren't paying attention to what else was on screen.
And I love that this episode feels like it's a little kid-friendly, or it's supposed to be a little kid-friendly, with some of these colorful designs, and it looks kind of has that, like, that Willy Wonka kind of look aesthetic to it, with, like, the arguing pair, or Dr. Seuss maybe a little more, too.
Dr. Seuss vibe.
Yeah. But then there's, like, the painted dancer, and you get, like, the close-up, like, full-camera view of, like, her butt.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa.
there's also the thing, you say it's for kids, but there's a lot of implied nudity throughout this episode, whether they're all naked in the mud bath, or Loxana Troi is strutting through the aisle in 10 Ford buck naked, you know, for her wedding.
Yeah, and you know what? This episode, revisiting it, the first time I watched it, I loathed it. Like, I really hated it. And I think a lot of the time, some of these episodes that I really hate initially, it's because it's like, what is going on? What am I watching? I tend to find when I go back and rewatch them, they become a little less offensive, and maybe I can take something from the episode that I enjoy.
Sure.
I will say, I think Majel Barrett is actually pretty good in this episode.
Well, I know you know this, but for listeners, this was the first episode she did after Gene Roddenberry had passed away, and she has gone on record saying this is a very important episode to her. And I do appreciate, like, her own arc through this one. She's somebody who is getting old. She's feeling lonely, which I think is something that is totally acceptable to be addressing here. And she doesn't want to be alone anymore. So, yeah, she'll do the equivalent of 24th century online dating and find this member of royalty, or he's a minister, but he's also royalty, what have you, who knows. But what did you think of his very uptight master of protocol, Cam?
Sid Farkas from the Seinfeld episode, the guy who has the bra salesman.
And the wasn't he the one that George tried to slip a Mickey to, or is that a different
No,
boss?
That's a different one. This is the guy who worked at the like the bra.
Okay.
George's going to be a bra salesman.
I know
the
one.
And Sid Farkas is the guy who interviewed him. I mean, he was pretty pretty tense. But I did like the idea, though, of Loxana finds herself in this position and is embracing it wholeheartedly, because it's just like, she, as you said, lonely, and this is a situation that might make her happier.
Might.
But I that moment where she has that talk with Alexander and talks about how, you know, one day, you know, you don't have your pick of the litter anymore, essentially, and she just wants to not be lonely anymore. I actually thought that was pretty powerful stuff in an episode that's really all over the place, tonally.
Well, okay, let me ask you. Okay, let's go back in the holodeck for a second.
Please.
Because you bring up it's all over the place tonally, but what do you think about the direction here? Because you're supposed to be dropped into this world of whimsy and swept away and everything. What did you think of the direction here in this, the way that this program was depicting this particular parallax colony?
It's very poor.
It's very 90s cheap kind of production cheap
is
value.
Cheap is the perfect word, because when we think of the holodeck, often the holodeck worlds feel very lived in and original and just have a lot of atmosphere. Like the parallax colony looks like it was just shot in like a park in California. And they just
it was shot in like the cheapest soundstage they could find. It wasn't even outdoor. I love like the outdoor natural lighting that we'll get in some holodeck adventures.
Right.
This didn't even have that.
No, like you compare that to the Once Upon a Time Flotter world.
Okay, yeah,
it's not even close.
I actually give that Flotter world a lot of credit for maybe they learned some lessons from cost of living there, because it actually felt as if I was in this kind of fictional world that people spend a lot of time thinking about. This seems like this holodeck writer just seemed to give it just more of an afterthought.
And it's not even like they could put some extras in there. Like, why not have more extras in there that look colorful or original?
Very empty.
Yeah, it's like empty space with like a juggler walking by.
Yeah,
it's like, why would you come here? Who built this program? Like, why is Loxana? How did she discover this program? And what keeps bringing her back?
Well, she's very lonely, Cam. She needs to find something to do.
Okay, so we know that she knows about this program, right?
Yeah.
Alexander does not. What is she going there all the time and doing? Who is she talking to?
She's the because juggler.
Is she just going and hanging out with the juggler?
I think so. And she's just smitten by him talking about eating his worlds, you know.
Is that what she's doing? Is that how sad this woman's life is?
Because would this world bring you any joy, Cam?
I mean,
you're not Loxana, but like, I can't imagine myself being in a situation where this would be giving me some sort of, at least take my mind off whatever is making me, you know, feel depressed.
Yeah, like I feel like it's supposed to be kind of like a Cirque du Soleil type world, you know, where it's just like anything can happen at any time. And you go in and it's like four actors in goofy makeup.
Cirque du Soleil minus the talent.
Yeah, it really is. Minus any sort of the wonder or the spectacle. It's just like an empty mud bath and like a guy that looks like the Cowardly Lion saying the what is it? The Mighty and the Few or something?
Well, I'm going back to this. It looked like a high school production.
Yeah.
You know, okay. It's okay.
It's, you know, okay. This episode... It's weird because I'm not someone that's a big Loxana Troi fan. I kind of enjoy when she shows up and has Picard kind of on edge. I think there's some good comedy that's come out of that, in at least in her first couple appearances. But I tend to find episodes that focus on her as a character, like, say, Dark Page, pretty painful. This one, I give it props for managing to tell a Loxana story that has a certain amount of poignancy to it. But it's a bad episode.
I'll give it props for this. That wind dancer has actually given us enough inside jokes between the two. I made gifs out of it. You've sent me photos of him making faces. To me, he makes it all worth it.
Yeah, because I mean, I really hated the B story. Like to me, with the food replicators like going nuts and stuff. Like I thought that was awful.
The metal parasite.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I will say, actually, Loxana Troi has a great zinger on Troi, Deanna Troi, where she says, like, I exposed you to all sorts of mixed messages when you were that age, and you still turned out deadly dull. I love that.
That made me laugh. Yeah.
So it is funny that this episode, despite being a dud, the two highlights of the episode are really, Loxana Troi moments. Because, I mean, I guess you could maybe throw in a third one. What do you think, for Worf in the mud bath at the end?
Yeah, I'll take it.
And did you feel that him and, you know, we started saying this episode is kind of built on him with Alexander. Did you feel that they learned anything by the end of this, really?
No, because they still have issues as father and son. And what was there really to learn at this point? Like,
yeah,
what at what point did Worf figure out the lesson to be a better, you know, Worf's a horrible father. I know he's a fan favorite character. Yeah. I think he's a great flawed character.
Yeah.
It doesn't make him a good father.
No.
So he's a legit bad father, but I think he realizes that. And they do address that in Deep Space Nine, which I'm glad that they do. But Cam, what's next on Mr. Hoffman's list here?
So we're jumping from 388 up 100 spots to 288.
Dear Lordy.
So we're getting to the upper echelon of Star Trek here.
And I'm looking at the list that we still have a couple episodes to talk about. I'm curious as to how he could rank these ones so high, but Cam?
Well, okay, so sandwiched in between the Drumhead from The Next Generation and Tears of the Prophets from Deep Space Nine.
Sure.
We have The Way to Eden from the original series. Now, we should preface our discussion and say this was the episode that I was hit with the most when we posted our best worst. People were like, how could you not do this episode?
Yeah. And
we ended up going with Spock's brain. We only did, I think, one TOS episode for that first part.
I think if you're doing best worst episodes and you're doing one episode for TOS, you have to go with Spock's brain. But
yeah.
I think Way to Eden is the next one on the list here, though. This, of course, is the Enterprise Encounter Space Hippies.
Yes.
And Cam?
No, that's about it.
Yeah. I don't get what the drama is. There's nothing going on in this episode except space hippies.
Okay, let's narrow it down. What is the drama? Is the drama, you know, Chekhov being reunited with this old love of his, Irena? Or is the drama about the space hippies wanting to take over the ship to find Eden?
I guess it's that and the nutty Dr. Severin. I like how they just talk to him for about, 30 seconds? And
yeah.
They're like, he's insane. I've clinically diagnosed him as insane. Just FYI. I'm just like, really? He actually seemed okay to me. He's an alien. I don't know.
It's like, how were all the rest of them not insane?
Yeah.
To me, like, the one played by Charles Napier, who wrote most of the songs himself.
And he did the a great impression of Jim Morrison, too.
Yeah.
Impression, I mean ripoff.
I mean, how is he not insane?
Yeah.
Or the one that looks kind of like the lead singer of Disturbed, but with a purple wig. He was pretty insane, too. Like, I don't understand how Severin jumps out as like, oh, that guy's mad. The other ones, they're okay.
But to me, it's just like, these are, Scotty first sees him on the transporter, and his eyes just go like saucer size. And
yeah.
I'm just like, Scotty, you deal with alien cultures all the time. Why is this like making you go mad? Or like, I don't understand. Like, the writers are expecting you to take a big leap and recognize them as hippies.
Yes.
And this is going to cause a lot of commotion on this paramilitary sort of vessel here.
Yeah.
It's a big leap that the writers are asking you to make when you're seeing when you're encountering aliens week to week as an audience. Like, why would the audience care at all that these people look kind of like hippies?
I don't know, and I wonder if this was a point where Star Trek just decided we're not cool. Because Star Trek was really popular with the counterculture movement.
Yeah.
Like this, Spock was like an icon for them. So I think it's really strange that they bring on the space hippies, and it's most of the crew just being like disgusted by them.
Although there was that one bridge officer when the music was playing on the PA
system.
Yes,
he was loving it.
Oh, he was just bouncing his head.
I love that about the original series. There will usually be like a background extra doing something just really weird.
But I love that they kept going. They cut to this bridge officer like three times.
Yes.
I was just like, okay, I can dig him. I need to go as him for my cosplay at the next convention. see if anybody gets it. Me just bobbing my head. I'll be like playing the space hippie music on like a on my iPhone the whole time and see if anybody can understand the reference.
Now we talked about the songs from this episode when we did episode 10 when we did our best and worst musical moments of Star Trek. Again, check the blog. I'll have a link to that episode. But Tyler, how do you feel these songs hold up all these years later?
I feel like there's okay. If you're a 30-year-old dude watching this in 1960s, maybe you're not right into the counterculture music scene, and maybe you're like, okay, I can understand this is hippie music, but to me, I'm just like, this is bad The Doors ripoff music, you know?
Right.
And I'm just like, this is, I'm sorry, you are not The Doors, and you're writing bad The Doors songs, and I just like, to me, I was just like, it sounds like 60s hippie music, but like really bad 60s hippie music. Like everybody thought they were like going to be the next big folk musician back in the day or rock musician, what have you. This fella didn't quite have it.
Well, he did not go on to have a rich musical career.
No? Play, did he at least play at Star Trek conventions well into the 80s?
I don't know that he did Star Trek conventions.
Why not? I mean, look, if he came out in costumes, in his costume, just think about all the photo op money.
There's
he
no way
gotten.
He was going to do that. He was a pretty well-established character actor for most of his life.
Doesn't matter.
But he was a huge figure in like 1960s goofball movies. He was in like Russ Meyer movies and stuff like that. So he definitely had one foot planted in that kind of weird, campy 60s world.
Cam, what did you make of the music, though? What did you
think? I don't hate it. I will say that. Like, I'm not going to say it's good, but it's kind of like Spinal Tap. It's the perfect type of silly where I can actually enjoy it. It's not just like, oh, this is unlistenable.
Oh, no, yeah, I didn't find it unlistenable. I just thought, like, the composer clearly ripping off much better music and not doing a good job of it.
How much time do you think he had to prepare those songs?
Oh, I would say best
like an
case
hour
scenario,
lunch break.
Well, I'll say realistically, best case scenario, maybe 2 or 3 days tops.
Yeah,
like not long.
Now Walter Koenig has said he really doesn't like this episode because of what it does to Chekhov. He feels it's a betrayal of the character. He was intended to be kind of the hip one of the crew, and you know, we do see in other episodes he's much has more of a youthful spirit and will get into trouble, like Spectre of the Gun or the Apple, and yet in this episode he's pretty much a square.
Okay, which tells you a lot about Starfleet, A, and then also just how counterculture they wanted these hippies to appear if Chekhov, the hip one, is now the square in this.
Right.
So I understand why, you know, Koenig is not pleased. This is not a great episode. I know. I can understand why he's not pleased with what he has to do, but I think it, from a writing perspective, it makes sense why he's in that position. So I kind of have to shrug my shoulders at that.
Now, what did you make of his relationship with Irina?
Didn't care.
Didn't care.
Were you invested in this?
Oh, so invested. No. I didn't really care. But this actually brings up a point. We had actually a listener write onto our Facebook account asking if we would be doing a McCoy episode anytime soon.
Right.
And then inquiring about McCoy's daughter, Joanna. Now, it was a real plan for the original series to bring Joanna into an episode and actually have her be a love interest for Kirk. The plan originally, which is kind of creepy, actually.
Yeah.
The original.
How old would Joanna have been?
Early 20s?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, it was 1968, I guess.
Okay.
But the plan originally was have Joanna be the Irina character and have Kirk have the romantic attachment to her. And then ultimately that just fell by the wayside. And then they were going to move Joanna to season 4, which of course never happened.
Sure.
But how do you think this episode would have been affected if it had been Joanna?
There would have been more drama and conflict that I would have felt invested in.
Right.
But with Chekhov and, you know, woman we'd never supposed to have any investment in, you just have to take Chekhov on his word that it was an important relationship.
Right.
Chekhov's young, though. I mean, people go out for like 3-4 months and then...
Sure.
You know, it's just like, whatever.
And plus, we've seen him with all these love interests in episodes surrounding that one. Whereas, like, I would actually be really interested in watching McCoy talk to his hippie daughter.
That would be fascinating.
Right? Like, yeah. Can you imagine those scenes?
I can imagine being uncomfortable watching it right now, Cam. I mean, well, imagine like how just like gruff and curmudgeon-y McCoy would have been throughout all this, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think, I can't imagine McCoy having a great relationship with his hippie daughter.
No. Do you think it would be better or worse than than Worf and Alexander?
Can you get worse than Worf and Alexander?
Probably not.
I think there would at least be that kind of father-daughter connection, you know, that there's at least some affection between the two. Do you think there's any sort of affection in the Worf-Alexander story?
Not really.
I feel really bad for Alexander. Go back to like cost of living for just a sec. He's talking about how much he misses his mother.
Yeah.
She's somebody who embraced her human half. So you place Alexander in like this real horrible situation, and he was growing up with initially with Worf's human parents, and then they didn't like him apparently, and I don't know, I just have to feel bad for Alexander. This kid had no hope. None.
Now there's two final points I wanted to ask you about with this episode. One, how did you feel this episode compares to Star Trek V, which rips off many elements from it? And also, how did you feel about the culmination of the episode where they actually land on Eden?
Look, I'm a total apologist for Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, so this does not hold a candle to that search for Eden slash God. I did think about that film when I watched this episode. You remember that moment when they were talking about Eden in Kirk's quarters in Star Trek V?
Yeah. And Severin is really a lot like Cybok.
Even just in the look of him.
Yeah.
You know, the landing on the planet, okay, yeah, a little bit on the nose that you eat the fruit and you die. Wow, that's creative, guys.
Well,
you know, I that metaphor didn't go over my head.
Well, this episode was co-written by DC Fontana, who changed her name to Michael Richards.
Wow.
For this episode. So, yeah, you know.
Kramer. Kramerica Enterprise.
Even the greatest talents don't hit a home run every time at bat. But like, this one's memorable.
Oh, yeah. Cam, what is the last one on our list?
So we are jumping from 288 up another over 100 spots.
Wow.
Sandwiched in between 169 Brothers and 167 Data's Day, we have Justice.
Jordan Hoffman, this has to be like your biggest guilty pleasure.
Yeah, because he says, too silly to hate. Wesley walks on flowers, pisses off sex joggers. Season one, man.
Okay, sex joggers. That's the best description for the Ito we could ever have. For those who don't recall, of course, the Enterprise encounter the Ito, this wonderful planet where lovemaking is all the rage.
At the drop of a hat.
More than just one hat.
Yeah.
Wesley, as Jordan Hoffman noted, steps on a flower patch and...
to be fair, he doesn't just step on it.
No.
He does something really stupid, which is like dive full body onto a greenhouse.
Yeah, would you ever do that as a kid?
No.
I wouldn't. I kind of think he kind of deserves his punishment. Yeah. Maybe not like to be euthanized. Like,
I think that's fine.
So anyways, Wesley's been sentenced to death for falling into some flowers, and
that's pretty much where the episode stops being fun.
No, I know. Yeah, the rest of the episode is just like so painful to sit through.
Yeah.
So who cares about that?
Because you've got like a satellite orbiting the planet and all that. And most of the episode really is Picard dealing with that satellite.
Yeah.
Which is really not interesting.
Not
although
at all.
It is another floating ball. You know, after the cost of living. So.
When that floating ball appeared on the Enterprise, it's like, wow, the Wind Dancer.
Yeah.
His first appearance.
Yeah.
Cam, we need to go and talk about the Ito, though, because this is some weird-ass stuff that's going on here.
This episode, like, I really enjoy, at least the first 23 minutes,
sure.
Which is the gold, you know, section. This episode, as much, you know, it's written by Warleaf Thorne and Ralph Willis, but forget them. This is Gene Roddenberry writ large.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I enjoy this episode because this is TOS big time.
Yeah. Look, we've got Riker coming up from this planet. He did initial inspection.
Oh, yeah.
He goes along with Picard's idea, like, let's bring Wesley down. Is this in any way a planet appropriate for children?
Well, Picard did say Wesley's assignment was to go and see if it would be a good place for children to relax.
I think that...
I thought that was a really bizarre... That's like a total, like, get Wesley off the ship assignment.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, Wesley was already hanging out the bridge at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Picard's like, I need to get him out of here.
Yeah.
Really. But, we go down to the planet. Our first encounter is Riker getting a big hug and going, Did you hear that grunt that he gave?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I loved all of this. Like, honestly, I can't... It really is... frankly humiliating to me to say how much I enjoyed the
it's
first 23 minutes.
Guilty pleasures.
It really is.
Yeah.
I was loving watching the, you know, the Ito like hit on Troy. And there's the guy, the male Ito, the main one. He has a scene where he's talking to Troy and Tasha Yar, and he reminded me so much of the close talker Judge Reinhold played
right.
in Seinfeld.
Yeah.
He is right up in their grill. And he has that like kind of like vaguely drugged smile on his face.
Well,
and it's so funny.
The women don't seem to mind. So
Troy seems a little kind of iffy.
By the time
on
you
it.
Get to the council chamber, she's okay. She's down with it.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
that's true.
Yeah, but I have to say this. What is Worf doing here? The Ito woman says, "Oh, I welcome this huge one. Oh yes." All the, like, subtext going on through this, because Cam, can we skip ahead just a few moments?
Yeah.
Talk about Wesley describing a baseball.
Oh, yes.
With his hand motions describing a bat, its length, its thickness.
This podcast episode is an episode of children doing inappropriate hand gestures, because you also have those kids in and the Children Shall Lead doing
yes.
very, very inappropriate hand motions.
I didn't want to be the one to bring it up, so I'm glad you did.
I loved it. It's like these furious expressions. And yes, you have Wesley doing this. This
very suggestive.
Yes, I don't even know any way to how to even put it. It's you have to watch it for yourself. Watch a clip of Wesley explaining baseball. It's bizarre.
But let's talk about those Edo children, because I remember the first time I watched this. Oh, not the first time, but like I watched this episode maybe a year back. No, you know, it was for our Love of Wesley episode that we covered. And my girlfriend walks in the room and she sees the Edo girl and she says, "How old is she?" Like, she was mortified about this outfit that this girl was wearing. I would hope she's 18 at the very least, but like this is like
I have my doubts.
Yeah, like how? What parent would let your like?
Oh, Hollywood parents. Okay. Oh, you don't want to know.
Okay, we've got her covered. What about? I like how they point to the children, and one of the boys, he's got like a bearskin rug on his chest, pretty much. Did you notice that?
Yeah,
this is like wow. That's a child.
How old is Wesley at this point? Do you think? How old is Will Wheaton roughly?
14, 15.
Okay.
And I love his reaction to everything.
Oh, there's it's so good. It's gold.
There's a lot of games I don't know yet. Like, Wesley's aware of what sex is.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but he's like, I'm not ready for this. Like, he's not having any of it. I don't blame him. You know, he's an inexperienced kid. He's not ready for it, but...
The only thing that would have made this episode even better would be to have Crusher standing beside him at all times.
That would have been fantastic. Why did Riker bring Wesley down here? I cannot wrap my head around that.
I don't know, because it doesn't seem like a place that...
It's not kid-appropriate.
You know what? It's like when I'm in Las Vegas, and I see those parents that bring children to Las Vegas. I'm like, why would you do this? I guess there are some sites to Vegas, but I'm still this is really not the place I'd be bringing children. This is that, you know, taken to infinity. Like, why would any... You know, like, Riker's been there. They've all been there. Why is Tasha Yar not being like, Riker, I don't know if that's the best idea.
Do you know what happened, though? Riker gets up to the bridge, and he's like, Picard, we have to go back. We have to go back right now. Picard's okay. Like, take Wesley. Riker's not even listening to Picard. He's just like, okay, we're going back. We're going back. Like, Riker doesn't care.
Okay, we know Riker is kind of a horn dog, right?
Sure.
Did he just want to take Wesley down, you know? You know,
help him
bro
help him
code
out. be the father figure that he never had. I can see that happening. It's
could that be it?
It may have been.
Is this a fan fiction script in the making?
Wait. have you been writing something, Cam?
No. It is something I wonder about, because Jonathan Frakes plays it very hammy. Like, there is no subtlety in his performance in this episode.
No.
In his approach to the Edo people. And I do wonder why he's that eager to get a teenage boy down there.
I think it's Gene Roddenberry all the way, thinking, it's about time.
I don't want to know about Gene Rod's trips out.
Wow.
But would you agree, like, this is Gene Roddenberry, like, his fingerprints are all over this episode.
Oh, of course. Because
you have, like, you know, the bubble that's, you know, examining Data, and it's speaking, like, the godlike booming voice.
Yeah.
All that stuff. It's actually, this episode is, and I don't know why it had never dawned on me before, how much this episode is like the original series episode, The Apple, which is similarly out there and weird. That one's actually a better episode, I think. This one's kind of a mess that's just really glorious to watch.
Cam, if it does not feature Wesley literally doing cartwheels, how could it even stack up?
You mean Wesley's stunt double?
We're watching... Okay, when you were 14, 15, were you out trying to impress girls by doing cartwheels in a park, Cam?
When I was 14 or 15, I'm pretty sure I was in a basement playing Mortal Kombat 2.
Yeah, okay.
And no girls were impressed, even though I knew all the fatalities.
Maybe you should have been doing cartwheels. I don't know. There's some... Okay, Wesley's saying... There's some games I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Like, I just love, like, Will Wheaton's delivery throughout all this. Like, in the best one ever, like, we have to touch upon this, Cam.
Touch upon it.
Wow. When the mediators come and Wesley admits to, like, crashing into the flower bed, and they say, "You admit this freely?" He's like, "I'm with Starfleet. We don't lie."
Yeah.
Like, that line delivery to me was something just Emmy-worthy, I would have to say.
you know, we talk about Wesley's on how awkward he is through this episode. How do you think Will Wheaton felt shooting this episode?
That must have been incredibly uncomfortable. Because right? Your parents are supposed to be on set with you as well if you're a child actor.
Yeah.
There's all this sexual innuendo going on. It's very clear that they're talking about games equals sex.
He's paired off with this, you know, attractive teenage girl wearing barely next clothed, to nothing.
Yeah.
It must have been a weird vibe on set. Because we're seeing it, and it's goofy and weird to us and kind of poppy. It's a very lightweight episode, at least for the first half. But for an actor in that position, it must have felt really weird. I mean, I'm sure the adults are laughing it up. I'm sure, you know, Jonathan Frakes is just like cackling the whole time he's shooting it.
You don't think he's feeling uncomfortable with Will Wheaton tagging along for all this?
I don't know. Do you think so?
I don't know.
I mean, Will Wheaton's not really around him that much.
Okay.
Really just one big scene.
Well, enough.
Yeah.
Big scene.
Big scene.
Well, Cam, sex joggers, yay or nay?
Well, yay.
Yeah.
But you can see, though, this episode, they ran out of gas. Like, by the end...
This is episode 8.
Not only that, this was the first script post-Encounter at Farpoint they worked on.
Oh, really?
This was the first commissioned script of the series.
Good God.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
This was what Gene Roddenberry was like, okay.
I've been out of the business.
We're blazing a new trail with Next Generation. Yeah. First episode, I want it to be justice. About a flower pot getting crushed.
He had a decade to come up with new Star Trek stuff since he did the motion picture.
And all those Phase 2 scripts, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, really? What do you think was going through his head?
Well, Cam, we should recommend for listeners to go back and review our Chaos on the Bridge episode. We recorded that back in September.
Yeah, early TNG, what went wrong.
Yeah.
Check the show notes on the blog.
Yeah, because we talk about the documentary that looks at all the quote-unquote Chaos on the Bridge going on in those early seasons of Next Generation, and people keep pointing to Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah.
Where I don't think he is in quite the right health and quite the right mind to be leading the resurgence of Star Trek. And this, to me, is just, it's god-awful.
Yeah. I mean, this would have fit well in the original series, but it still would have been a bad episode of the original series.
Yeah. But then now you just have 80s aesthetics.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, what am I, this is just garbage.
And you can tell, like, they just had, even for, you know, like a bad TOS episode, it would have been bad because it peters out. Like, I guess you could make an argument, you know, that Picard has to go through the prime directive in dealing with these people. He gives up on that by the end. He's like, beam us out of here.
I would do that in the same situation.
Me too. But then he just like talks to like the heavens. He gives like one sentence about, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, an all 100% law essentially. And then the alien being lets them through and it's like, wow, that was easy.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a defense, Picard. Not one of your proudest victories. But yeah, justice. It's something.
Okay. Well, Cam, before we wrap up this episode, maybe some Star Trek Discovery casting news that we can discuss.
Some best worst Discovery casting news.
Well, the one big news is it's official. Sonequa Martin-Green, she is the lead actress, lead character playing one, Michael Burnham.
Michael?
Yeah.
Was it Michael? I thought it was Michelle.
No, it's Michael.
Oh, dear.
Are you being serious right now?
Yeah.
No, she's playing. I thought you were being like the typical trolling Star Trek fan.
No, I wasn't at all.
Oh, Star Trek fans on social media are up in arms at a woman character is named Michael.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyways, no, she's playing Michael.
Color me embarrassed.
Yeah. Michael Burnham, the first officer aboard the Discovery. Oh. Yeah, Cam's looking up on his phone.
Yeah.
Cam did not believe
me. I totally
me.
Misread it.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't even.
Okay. Well, there you go. So it's official. I guess we can freely talk about it now. But,
sure.
There you go. What do you think, Cam? You're not familiar with this actress at all.
No, it means nothing to me.
Yeah.
And it was funny because, everyone was posting this today. And I'm like, wait, didn't we know this long ago? But I guess it was the name, right?
Well, it was never officially announced. It was just the trade. No. It's just the trade said, oh, by the way, this person's been cast on the show.
Yeah.
There's a very obvious reason why CBS never made the announcement is because this actress who I'm familiar with from The Walking Dead, they wanted to let her finish the present season of The Walking Dead before they made any official announcement.
Right.
So there you go. I think she has potential with Discovery as lead actress. Looking forward to whatever she brings to the table. I have a little bit more to say about the other casting news.
This is the worst.
Well, okay. Yeah. So Rainn Wilson, actor that I'm a big fan of from The Office. He played Dwight Schrute on The Office. He's been cast as Harry Mudd. They're bringing Harry Mudd back to the franchise, Cam.
Yeah.
You probably get the sense about how I feel about this. I'll go into further detail, but yeah. I'm just curious, what's your reaction to the return of Harry Mudd to the franchise and with Rainn Wilson playing this character?
I think with me, Harry, let me put it this way. Harry Mudd is not in any of my favorite TOS episodes.
Right.
I don't really care that much about any of them, and I don't even care that much about the animated episode. I don't even think that's in the upper tier of animated episodes, which is a lower tier than TOS.
Sure.
But I mean, I'm kind of like, I guess, a wait and see, because I know he's a character that's kind of durable because he's a con man. He could be involved in any kind of illicit scheme. So I'm debating why they want to use him. I know he's popular. Fans who I always see dressed up at cons. It seems more surprising to me that they're like, let's announce Harry Mudd right out of the gate. Like, to me, he's a character you'd think, if they want to bring him back, and that's a big if, at least in my mind, it would be later down the road. And, you know, just a bit part. You know, sure. Kind of like how, was it Into Darkness just had like a name mention of him?
Yeah. I think they referred to the Mudd incident.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I thought we would get. I never thought we would have a major star cast as Harry Mudd.
Well, what do you think of the casting of Rainn Wilson taking over this role?
I don't think he's the right type. I mean, Roger Carmel, who played Harry Mudd originally, was kind of a big, jovial man. I don't really get that with Rainn Wilson.
Yeah. Performance-wise, I'm very... Like, I watched every single episode of The Office. I don't think you've ever watched it before, have you?
Not really.
Yeah.
I've seen, like, an episode or two.
I totally think Rainn Wilson can do it. You say big, jovial man. I don't think... Look, this Discovery takes place 10 years before the original series. He has lots of time to pack on some pounds.
Is he going to have a mustache?
Maybe.
He has to, right?
Does he? He's got 10 years to grow it.
That's true.
I'm not too...
Is this the origin of his mustache?
Here's the thing. I don't care about that sort of stuff.
Sure.
This is, to me, a lose-lose proposition for the writers. Because I brought this up before when we've discussed this character. They really celebrate this guy who's a pimp. Like, mm-hmm. He's a sex trafficker. And they celebrate the character for that. And
well,
Cam.
Yeah, yeah, no, go.
They do. They do, absolutely. It's not, they don't ever find his behavior to be reprehensible. It's not regarded as something that we should find disgusting or revolting. He is a sex trafficker, and people like, oh, it was 60s television, it was a different time. That's not any sort of excuse, though.
No, it's not. But you're touching on a really weird aspect of pop culture in the 60s that was revisited kind of in the early 2000s of embracing pimp culture. In the 60s, that was a weirdly popular thing to do. You had also like Paint Your Wagon, which is like a 3-hour musical about pimps played by like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood, bringing, you know, prostitutes to the Wild West. And it's like, hooray for them. And it kind of goes into the 70s. You've got like McCabe and Mrs. Miller with Warren Beatty as a pimp. You've got, of course, the famous Huggy Bear in Starsky and Hutch. And you get that character from Starsky and Hutch coming back in the 2000s, where again you had like rap artists really embracing pimp culture, and Snoop Dogg was hanging out with pimps in his entourage.
Okay,
it's a weird thing, and I'm not. I will never defend it.
I agree, it's bad.
But it's again, it's it, yeah. You're right.
I'm saying,
it's,
who cares? Who cares that's what was going on culturally? It's now.
It's bad. It's I get it. It's idiotic to even reference it, but I agree with you.
Here's why it's a lose-lose proposition for the writers. There, you're bringing back a character whose behavior was originally celebrated. So you have either one option where you go back and you kind of celebrate that character once again. You brought up a point where we were going back and forth between text message about how, well, he's not a sex trafficker yet.
Yes.
So here's the thing. What you're doing is either painting this character as kind of a rascal sort of guy, and hey, so what? He might become a sex trafficker one day, but he's still a lovable kind of rogue.
Right.
So you have the issue where you're not going to condemn what's really kind of a vile character that we know he becomes. And or else you have the other option where you do condemn the character, that you do portray him as kind of this vile sort of thing that the 60s era did not do.
Yes, of course.
Which then alienates all the hardcore fans and I think there's a few too many fans that look past his big vocation as this pimp. You know? So it's lose-lose for the writers. They're either going to be accused of being totally like... obtuse to this whole sex trafficking thing, or else they're going to be accused of totally ruining like a character that many people find like quite beloved, you know? So it's like no good is going to come out of this.
I just like I agree with you. He's a character that I think represents, again, like an outdated pop culture idea. And I don't really understand if you're going to bring something else back. Because, you know, we did our episode of characters we want to see back on Discovery. I don't think Harry Mudd was on the list, was he? I think we said Cyrano Jones.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we referenced Harry Mudd and said, do you think he'll come back? And I think you said, yeah, I think they probably will.
Yeah.
But I am curious, like, why bother? Like, what is it? Like, let the fans of the original series have this character if they want to continue to, you know, cosplay as whatever. They have those episodes if they want. I just don't understand why. There's a lot of rich terrain of storytelling in the universe of Star Trek. In what world are we like, you know what? We have Harry Mudd stories to tell.
If you want a con man,
sure.
Then just grab Cyrano Jones.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the issue.
Or a new character.
Sure. Yeah. Here's the thing. They want to bring back like a recognizable character, like that recognizable name. Cyrano Jones doesn't have as much name value as, say, Harry Mudd does.
And that Harry Mudd casting story got a lot of press.
So
that kind of tells you why they did it, probably.
But I just think, Cam, you can tell that this irks me quite a bit. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are thinking I'm some weird PC snowflake for getting so upended about this. But I really think this is the first big mistake on the part of the writers that I'm seeing here, because it's a no-win situation no matter which way you go in this. So I'm not pleased.
Well, my thing with Harry Mudd too is like the original Harry Mudd incarnations were created to service a type of comedy that it simply doesn't work anymore. Like it's not funny to us. And it shouldn't be funny to us at this point in time, 50 years later, right?
It should not have been funny 50 years ago.
Shouldn't have been, but was for whatever reason. I really don't understand why.
Well, people were big into like those minstrel plays like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have been funny at the time either, you know?
You know, society progresses as it progresses, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, to me, it's an outdated form of comedy. And look, again, fans can have those episodes if they want. I just don't understand why you would want. It's not like Harry Mudd in the original series serviced more than that type of comedy. It's not like you had your Harry Mudd comedy episodes and then like the serious episode where he helped with a mission. You never had that. So it's like, what are we trying to do? It's not like this character was multidimensional. You know what I mean? It's not like you could say, well, that was one facet. Let's cut that part out and focus more on the other. It's like, nope, that's all he was.
Yeah.
So what is the kind of the point? I mean, I'm fascinated to see, but I've never finished watching a Harry Mudd episode and been like, that's one of my all-time favorites. And I have serious doubts that Discovery is going to deliver the Harry Mudd episode that's going to belong in the upper echelon of Trek for me.
Yeah. Honestly, Cam, my guess, though, is this is a character. He's going to be celebrated as kind of a rascally rogue. They're not going to address any of the sex trafficking stuff.
They definitely won't be.
Well, they could just justify it as like, well, he's not doing it yet. Yeah. And so he's going to be a celebrated character. And that irks me because the problem is if you're following the same continuity, he's still celebrated within the universe as the pimp. So that's why this is just a big mistake. So, okay, sir.
Well, I can't wait until Discovery airs and we can see if that's the only mistake they make.
Okay. Let's hold on to this clip for a few months and see if I'm proven completely wrong.
Yeah. We'll see.
We'll see.
Okay. So on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, I believe we also have a Facebook account.
Yeah, find us on facebook.com/subspacepod. That's facebook.com/subspacepod, or just search Subspace Transmissions if you go in your search bar on Facebook. I encourage everybody, look, free podcasts, like us on Facebook. That's all we really ask. It helps more people discover it. We're also offering exclusive content that you can't get here on the podcast all over Facebook. Cam, we just posted our first exclusive episode.
That's right.
Something we have never done before with regards to the way we tackle a particular Subspace Transmissions episode. Go check it out on Facebook. It's fun. We are not filling up your accounts nonstop. We post, maybe two or three times a week?
About that.
Yeah. So, yeah guys, just follow it. We'll have a lot of fun there, too. And you also give us 5 stars on iTunes if you can. That helps other people discover the show. Again, guys, it's free. You're like, all we're asking is just a little support. It helps my self-esteem quite a bit. Yeah.
Now, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we're talking all about the Andorians. We've tackled the Tellarites just a few weeks ago. I think we want to hit the other charter members of the Federation, those founding members. So why not tackle the very iconic-looking ones, the Andorians, first featured in TOS and then on Enterprise as well.
I'll go find a clip of that Eiffel 65 song to open the episode.
I can't wait.
So you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vanilla, and Coconut Smith.
They're both white. You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in nude in a mud bath.
So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.